she felt that his kicking, as you said, was deliberate evil. And she responded by wishes for an abortion and also stopped breastfeeding at the point because she felt that his sucking was so strong and aggressive that it was destroying her. And without the father as a triangulating object, I mean, he had no one to contain. I mean, this every child needs a container of all the aggression.
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and Off the Couch. This podcast series introduces the many analysts around the world who, in addition to working in their consulting rooms on the couch, they also work outside their offices. They take their psychoanalytic skills and they bring them to many other venues. They bring them to hospitals, to refugee centers, to business leaders, to childcare clinics, to prisons, just to name a sampling of the many conversations we've had. We've also spoken with analysts again around the world about how they and their patients have been struggling with the COVID crisis. And finally, we speak to a group of analysts who meet the criteria, shall we say, of being the elders of our field. They have been practicing analysis for 40 and 50 years and have special perspectives on this particular period of history and an overview on what the field has been like and how it's evolved over the past half century. I hope you find these conversations engaging and thought-provoking. Please feel free to write comments at our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, and thank you for listening. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Dr. Siri Gulistar. Dr. Gulistar is Professor Emeritus of Clinical Psychology at the University of Oslo, and she's a training and supervising psychoanalyst. She's a former head of the Department of Psychology and the former president of the Norwegian Psychoanalytic Association. She's the author of many articles and books. Her most recent book is Theory and Practice of Psychoanalytic Therapy, Listening for the Subtext. She is also awarded the Sigourney Prize in 2019. Our conversation today derives from an event that took place 10 years ago in Norway. In July 22, 2011, there was the largest mass murder in Norway since World War II. Anders Breivik, a self-proclaimed right-wing ideologue, murdered 77 individuals and injured hundreds more in an effort he claimed to, quote, save Europe from multiculturalism. This introduces a fascinating subject because it turns out that there is a great deal of clinical data about his upbringing and his family as he was hospitalized with his family at the age of 4. And so the question is, what does psychoanalytic hypothesizing tell us? How is it useful to understand situations like this? And what relationship does it have with cultural ideology? This is the topic of conversation. Dr. Gulistar has written 2 papers in English that are quite thorough and quite thoughtful, and I highly recommend them. And I hope you enjoy our conversation as much as I did. Siri, welcome to the podcast. It's so nice to have you here. July 22nd, 2021 marks the 10-year anniversary of the largest mass murder in Norway's history since World War II. At that time, Anders Breivik murdered 77 people. Norway was stunned, especially as he readily admitted to his actions, and he saw it as part of a right-wing ideology. It was his effort, he said, to save Norway. At his trial, the first question, of course, is he insane? As I've learned, Norwegian law has a category of insanity, at which point he would not be responsible for his deeds. There was a group of forensic experts called in. They diagnosed him as paranoid schizophrenic and said that he was not liable for the crime. This was met by an outcry, not just from the Norwegian population, but especially from those survivors who witnessed him in a very calculated way murder their friends and children. And also, given the extensive planning he had to go through to plan this calamity. So unusually, again, my understanding is it's very unusual in Norwegian law for a second panel of experts to be called in, but that's what happened. And they deemed him to be not paranoid schizophrenic and suitable for trial. Which is where my understanding is that your thinking comes in. That is, how do we understand this man? How do we understand his inner life? And how do we understand it as it relates to the culture at large and the ideology from which he claims allegiance? Now, unusually for this man, there's a great deal of history. First-hand history. He was hospitalized along with his family at the age of 4 and carefully studied by a large group of clinicians. And there's a great deal of information about the disturbed family he came from. However, as you point out in your 2 papers in English on the subject, there's a need for humility in considering the origin, the internal origin of this man's illness. You write, in psychoanalysis, the validity of an interpretation lies in the dialogue with the patient. And here, there is no such dialogue. So we have material, but we can't confirm the material. Let me pause there, Siri, and invite you to share with our audience, who is likely not very familiar with this, what Norway was like 10 years ago, if you would describe his crime, and then we can sort of tackle this issue of what it means to understand a man's internal life to the extent we can, and what's its relation to the culture at large.
Yes, let me try. Norway is a very peaceful country. I mean, stable, social, democratic country, even if there are different governments. So this mass murder came, as you said, as a complete shock. He first blew up the headquarters of the government in the center of Oslo, placing a bomb in a self-made bomb in a car, which he drove up to the building. I mean, there's been a very much questioning about how could that happen. That's another question, but how the lack of security and so on. Then, after the blow up of the building, he dressed as a policeman. He drove the 40 kilometers to Utøya, which is a small island, where the Social Democratic Party usually have their summer camps for younger people. So around 600 people, something like that, was gathered there. And they had all heard about the bomb in Oslo Center. Everyone had at that time he arrived there. And so he pretended to be a policeman coming to help them. So they, as you also said, during 1 hour he killed them in cold blood, one by one, shot in the chest, in the head, through hands, helplessly trying to protect the face. So all 69 youths and children. His initial plan, and that's important, was to execute Gro Harlem Brundtland, which is a former prime minister of Norway. And she is a really symbol of the victories of modern feminism. She changed Norway in terms of laws, right for women and so on. And she, the plan was that she was to give a political speech at Utøya, because they have, it's a political camp, this summer camp, and they have invited guests. And also the prime minister, who was prime minister and now the head of NATO, Jens Stoltenberg, he was also, had been there. But Anders Behring Breivik had planned to decapitate Brundtland, to videotape it and put it on the internet, modeling an Al-Qaeda operation. But this plan had to be changed because Breivik was delayed. Yes, so that's sort of what happened. I think you asked me about how I came into this in a way.
Yes.
Because you very precisely reported about how one immediately said, well, we have to have a forensic observation of this man. He must be mad, and so on, and these two reports. But on the other hand, I mean, he himself said that he declared that he was motivated by ideology. And you didn't mention that, but he, at the same time as he blew up the bomb, he issued on the internet a manifesto of 1,500 pages. So the deed, the murders were was intended to be a wake-up call for the message which was written in the manifesto, and the essence of which is that Norway is threatened by Eurabia, that is Europe dominated by Muslims. So he was a self-proclaimed savior in a way. It was, and he said repeatedly during the trial, it was horrible what I did. He recognized that, but it was necessary. So he had to do this sort of job, if you want, to make people see what a threat we were faced with immigration.
Can I just ask you about that? His saying it's horrible in the trial, my understanding is he said it without any affect.
Yeah. That's very precisely pointed out, because that's a main, from a sort of psychoanalytic point of view, I would say that's a main characteristic of his personality, this isolation of affects, this false self, I'd like to call it, that sort of split off from real affects. That's from he was 4 years old, that was... one of the things that struck me when I read that, as you said, he was hospitalized with his mother and his sister at this famous or well-known child psychiatric unit in Oslo. And one of the psychologist observation of Anders was that he had this put-on averting smile. I mean, no spontaneity, no capacity for play, no pleasure in a way, but this orderly, controlled, and this, so I imagined that was my way of sort of picturing it as a beginning development of a false self.
The question we face in trying to understand this is that there are many people who come from very disturbed families. There are not many people who commit crimes of this order. And so our question is, as fascinating clinically as his disturbed past is and his disturbed thinking is, what do we do with that? You call for or identify this dialectic between the inner psychology of the individual and the ideology that he is affiliated with. Can you say more about what that means for you?
Just one step back, because I forgot to say where you asked me about how what I said, how I come into this. And it was, as you said, this it was a polarized sort of debate about how to understand his action, because, as you said, the psychiatrist and so on, he must be ill, mad. And then the experts on, political scientists all said, well, this is a typical right-wing ideology. So sort of my position as a psychoanalyst, I participated in the public debate at the time. And sort of it struck me that psychoanalysis really has power as a science of the unconscious in a way, in that I was in the position to ask the obvious question for us, psychoanalysts, obvious question that is it possible that the demonization of Muslims fits into a psychologically threatened universe and emerges lust for revenge? So can we understand his ideology as expressing inner dynamic forces? And that was my way which is what psychoanalysis gives the possibility for, I would say, this understanding of social, ideological thinking, political movements, which has been, an interest of mine since I was young. I was this combination or this applied psychoanalysis where you try to understand the important social forces, ideological movements and so on the basis of inner dynamics. And then, as you say, I think it's important to emphasize the dialectics between them, because as you also said, the many people think like him, but they don't do what he did. They don't murder. And that's where we need to have the inner dynamics to explain that. But the passage, the passage from thought to action also requires ideology as a legitimizing factor, I think.
That's a key point. The your understanding of what allowed him to take the thought and act on it was the ideology. One thing that's not clear to me is, was he part of a large group? My understanding is that no one from the extreme right or from any political party came to support him. They didn't speak on his behalf. There was no uprising. There were no other acts. Is it fair to say he was a disturbed loner?
Yes, you can say that. I would definitely say he was a disturbed loner, and he had planned this act for years. I mean, there was years of planning of making the bomb, and he sat on the internet for 12 hours a day and sort of de-emotionalizing himself, preparing himself for for doing what he thought he had to do, and so on. But it's a disturbed inner world, which we can understand psychoanalytically. I've used some concepts. I think the concept of splitting is central. The concept of the mythification of the self, his blown up self-image to be the savior of Europe, which defends against an underlying feeling of weakness and of being a loser. That's sort of a couple of concepts.
And whose mother reportedly said she wished she had aborted him.
Yes, central. I think if you go sort of to the more individual dynamics, we need to look at the relationship between mother and son, which I think is quite disturbed. I mean, his mother and father was divorced. There was no father there. And his mother was, according to the psychiatric report, clearly disturbed in her interaction with the little boy. I mean, she on the one hand, she pulled him tightly against her and on the other hand, aggressively pushed him away, and she experienced him as as evil. She even used that word because he was kicking when he was not yet born. I mean, in her, yeah. And sort of characterized by much projection. I mean, she saw him in him, her little son, all that was evil with men in general. She had a very difficult relationship with his father. And Anders, on the other hand, I think there was this sort of experience of boundlessness. That's a word, isn't it? I mean,
yes, yes.
I think the I didn't mention Winnicott in that in the article I wrote about it, but I think this in Winnicott's article about the use of an object could help us understand in a way, because Winnicott's idea is this very central, I think, clinically very central idea of the need for the child that the parent survive the attacks, the aggression, and she did not survive. I mean, she felt that his kicking, as you said, was deliberate evil. And she responded by wishes for an abortion and also stopped breastfeeding at the point because she felt that his sucking was so strong and aggressive that it was destroying her. So, and without the father as a triangulating object, I mean, he had no one to contain. I mean, this every child needs a container of all the... so that I think is a fruitful hypothesis for explaining what we see as the murderous rage, which must underlie the evil rage, which underlies this killing, but then what was projected, his inner war projected and as a war going out there, and legitimized also with reference to the ongoing social war.
I take your point to be that just as the mother saw him as evil, absent his separation from his mother, he took that in as a whole piece and then identified with her and saw others as evil and never metabolized, like you said, through the presence of a triangulating father. Yeah. This question of its relation to the ideology, because so far what you've described is sort of easy to understand. Mm. Again, we're hypothesizing. We're talking about a very disturbed person who was treated with the same cruelty with which he treated others, just about. He wasn't physically killed. But then there's the leap to the ideology, which I don't have my hands on yet, what that leap is. For example, in his manifesto, you say he wrote a 1,500-page manifesto. The only time he showed affect in the trial is when the manifesto was put on the screen for everyone to see. And among the many, many things he said in the manifesto is that in this new society that he's trying to build, fathers should get custody of their children, if there's any question. Now, as we know from his history, he was the object of a custody fight, and the father did request custody. The judge, however, gave custody to the mother. Mm. So here we have this individual event of not having contact with his father as he wished to. And then he commits this heinous crime and makes a manifesto saying, sort of, I should have stayed with you, Dad. This is the way it should be. Mm. So how do we help me make the leap to what the ideology is other than just an externalization of his psychology?
Yes, I just wanted to emphasize what you just said about his what is this patriarchal ideology, which permeates the manifesto. And in my reading of it, I really was struck by the affective intensity in the hatred towards feminism, which is even more intense, as I feel it, than his hatred against Muslims. And he, I mean, he says a lot about how his hate, he hates the feminization of himself. As I say, normally you have to learn, boys have to learn to knit and sew, you know, in school. And also the full of contempt of the sexualization, young girls giving oral sex, as he says, when they are 12 years old. The lack of the father having the authority. And that's the childhood, so to speak. But we also have, I think we psychoanalysts, we often put a lot of emphasis, and rightly so, on the childhood. But then there is the adolescent. And that's the period where the young person finds his own identity in the group and so on. And I know you have interviewed Werner Borleber from Germany before, and I've cited him. It's a very good book about extreme ideology and how what motivates young people. And you find your identity in the group, even if he's a loner. He experiences. You asked about Norway, and I said it's a peaceful country, but the 80s where he grew up, 1980s, that was the Norway's sort of first confrontation with multiculturalism. And a lot of immigrants and the connection of the underground between East and West, where gangs from the East, Pakistani gangs, for instance, coming to rob the children of the rich neighborhoods. And this was his social, cultural background in his teens. So, which also is decisive in forming how he understands the world in a way. And I cited in my article as a member of English Defense League, a parallel sort of right-wing movement, saying they about the Muslims that they come here and they take our jobs and our women. So, I mean, in that spirit, in a way, Anders also lived, I mean, feeling threatened by. And also admiring those, that's a paradox, because one of his close friends was a Pakistani boy, one of the leader of the gang, and he was, and he also admired them because these boys were not feminized.
It was the masculinity that he could only approach.
Yeah.
In a cartoon way.
Yeah,
that's
a precise, fine.
So are we left to wonder that had his father gained custody of him, then the murders might not have taken place, A, and B, had multiculturalism not taken the form it did during his vulnerable youth, then as well the murders might not have taken place? Are those two fair hypotheses?
Yeah, of course, as you said, we need to be humble.
Actually, it was your word. I want to give you full credit for that, because analysts often aren't.
Yeah, because, this disturbed relationship to the mother. I also, you haven't mentioned yet, but this incident, which I put emphasis on, that he gave his mother a vibrator.
And he was in his 20s at the time.
Yeah, right? He was in his 20s. He was a grown-up man. Yeah. So, I mean, it's really, it condenses, you can only sort of imagine.
Sure.
I mean, contempt and power to satisfy, I mean, Oedipal victory, and Oedipal victory because the father was absent. So, Oedipal catastrophe, I would say.
Yes, so, sure.
In that sense, and the other about the multiculturalism, I think that points to an important fact that, I mean, every paranoid system has a kernel of truth in it, that we know as clinicians, don't we? So, mm-hmm. I mean, sure. He, there's one book, a very good book about Breivik called One of Us, written by Åsne Seierstad, a very good journalist. She calls her book One of Us, pointing to the fact that he was one of the ordinary youth growing up on Oslo West, sort of better neighborhood in a way. So feeling like him, that, well, my city is changing, nothing is the same anymore. It's a real feeling of change that I think the politically correct Norway has been slow sort of to recognize that people and Sweden even more than Norway to put it sharply, I mean to be so concerned about, which is a humanist sort of vision, to of course to want to integrate and welcome people of other cultures, but not sort of to the same extent recognizing the feeling of threat that many people may feel of losing their familiar neighborhood to, yeah. Do I make myself clear?
Very. So you're saying that one has to respect not just the wish to open one's culture to other cultures, mm. but one also has to respect the wish for the familiar,
yes.
and the loss of the familiar.
Yeah,
and yeah. there isn't an easy answer, but clearly one answer can't be to ignore either one of those poles.
That's correct.
Because when you do, I guess you're saying that people who are disturbed as he is will use that tension and have it be a stimulus, if not an excuse, mm. to act out their most primitive fantasies.
Yes, and I mean, what is he attacking? I mean, he's not attacking Muslims. I mean, that has been the case many places in the world that you go for,
right.
or mosques, or what's it's called that in English, mosques, or synagogues if you're anti-Semite, and so on.
Right.
But he attacks the Social Democrats, which he accuses of having not understood, because the Social Democrats have been in power since, for most of the years since the Second World War in Norway. So, I mean, not all the time, but I mean, they are responsible for letting this happen. Hmm. That was his logic for attacking.
That perhaps goes back to your reference to where was father to help contain the out of control engulfing mother experience.
And that's, in my opinion, also is one of the most destructive effects. Really, it's so heartbreaking to read so many of all those the stories of the young people that were killed. Really, you know, the most gifted peoples of their generations who had become leaders in the north and Norway there and there, you know, there. So he really, the Social Democratic Party has a lack of people from that generation now. So, I mean, killing, that is horrible to think about.
The anniversary will be in a couple of months. Is it already being spoken of? Are there ceremonies? What's planned?
Yeah, I mean, lots spoken of. I mean, the youth organization now has sort of announced that they will. We need more ideological debate about how could this ideology grow like this. So, because, you know, the first response, I don't know if you've seen the speeches of our Prime Minister Jens Stoltenberg at the time. I mean, he was he said we need to respond with love in a way. We need to not let this dominate us. We will not let the destructivity take over. So now there's more a debate about how can we sort of more thoroughly discuss the ideology, the right-wing ideology that made this sort of possible.
I can't, when you quote the Prime Minister and his emphasis on love, I can't quite read the spirit with which you say it. I can't tell if it's admiring or dismissive.
No, he was, it was in a way fantastic how he, I mean, he is from the Social Democrat, he was a Social Democrat. You know him. I mean, he's the General Secretary of NATO.
Yes.
Yeah.
I learned
he's
that.
He's a very, I mean, gifted man and a very empathic sort of charisma, I would say. And it was, I mean, he cried. I mean, he lost his best friends out there. Yeah. And he cried openly and but sort of saying that we need to not let this sort of destroy us. But I mean, what's in a way lacking, maybe you could say, the anger, I mean, the sort of
righteous
counter-aggression that you really...
Your thought about being sensitive to both sides of the cultural challenge, the side that opens your community to other cultures and the side that protects your community and keeps it what it has been. Has that been a conversation?
Yes, to some extent maybe, but in a way I don't think enough. I think we need a more thorough discussion about that. But, I mean, there is, the integration in Norway is, that has to be said, it is going quite well or very well as compared with many other countries. I mean, it's interesting to compare with Sweden. That's a long story, but, I mean, you had a much greater denial of the problems connected with the immigration than in Norway. So
Denmark too is struggling. Yes.
Yes. There has been a movement now towards much more strict regulation. So that's the way the Social Democrats has handled it there to more severe or not severe, strict. I think it's good, isn't it? Yes.
Do you connect this? I don't know if you would want to call it an authoritative culture, the right wing culture that he is affiliated with. Do you link it with other right wing movements in the world today and in the past? Do they have common themes that connect them?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's one of the merits of Werner Borlaug's writing and thinking, that he sort of points out a similarity, this quest for, this singles out two concepts, the concept of purity and the concept of unity, and there's a and I think it's his sentence. He says, "Where if the identity project of the young person is very difficult, like it was with Anders, because he so much wanted to be a success, and he was somehow weird or strange. So he was always an outsider, a loser in a way. So then the question of who I am." May be replaced by the question, where do I belong? So it's the group in the ideology group. Gives a solution to the difficult the identity question. Is difficult for all of us, isn't it? So, And that's the same we say is we see with the radicalization of the young Muslims. I mean, it's discussed right now some of the ISIS, the IS, coming back home to Norway. Now there is a trial going on. I mean, why did she join and so on? And it's absolutely the same sort of mechanisms that you belong to a group which you think fight the right.
Right.
Yes.
Is there any information about that person? I hadn't heard about that trial of the ISIS woman. Is there information about her early childhood?
Not in the same way. I mean, but she felt a gifted girl, good in school and so on, but felt that she didn't find her own Muslim identity in Norway. So she had to go to Syria, I mean, to join the caliphate. I mean, this vision of this Muslim caliphate, as you know. To find oneself in a group, that's a parallel. But I have not much information about the personal history. Yeah. No.
Putting aside, obviously artificially, the unspeakable evil and tragedy that took place, is Norway, in your view, more thoughtful today than it was 10 years ago as a result of this tragedy?
Yes, I would say not too strong, but a little yes, yes.
It's a soft yes, yes, right, a little yes, right.
Yeah. Soft yes. Right. Yeah. But, I mean, it made us begin more a dialogue about, how come that a person can come to think like this in a peaceful country like ours, in a way. Mm. But I think
was there any impact on the custody laws, where apparently the mother always gets the child?
Has changed, not because of this Breivik case, but I mean there's a. There's been a lot of change. I mean, I think Norway has one of the most sort of laws of Norway give a lot of privileges now more to the father.
I see.
So,
yeah.
I mean, you see no other country where so many men go about with children, you know. They have paid father leave. It's exclusively reserved for the father. So that was begun by Gro Harlem Brundtland, the woman that he, on the Spering Breivik, wanted to decapitate. And, but I think I haven't answered, and I think it's not in a way fully answerable, the question about the passage from thought to action. I mean, that is...
That's the key question.
Yeah.
And, whether you look inside the individual or you look outside, obviously the answer would have to be both. But different people look in different places and use different instruments to look in each place. But that is the question, because as you write so beautifully, that there are many people who struggle with these grandiose imaginings of destruction. But fortunately, so few actually act on them. And he was different.
Yeah.
Something was different about him. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I wish I could find some optimistic note for us to close on. And what I will say is that for any of our listeners who are interested in this, reading your two papers, which will be in the notes included in this podcast, are really a treat. You think... And write so beautifully and so clearly as an analyst, and you really invite us into the mind of the individual while maintaining your humility and focusing on the speculative nature of your imaginings. It is a treat to read your writings, and I thank you for that. And thank you for being with us. I hope the 10-year anniversary goes well for you and your country, and in something useful grows out of it.
Yeah. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.